So, welcome to the Keen on Yoga podcast, and again, you've got me today. It's a solo podcast. Yeah, I know, I'm sorry. So currently, I'm in Turkey, in the south of Turkey. Well, near Izmir, so I guess it's in the south, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong. And doing a couple of days teaching, then heading to Istanbul, and then after Istanbul, we've got a lot of workshops this year lined up. Bucharest, Tenerife, Paris. No, we're not in Paris this year. But we've got a lot of them. So look on the website if you fancy catching up with me. A few retreats, lots of weekend workshops. And if you want me to come somewhere and I haven't come there yet, just email me and I'm sure we can make it work next year. Right? Totally open for invites to anywhere nice, anywhere that you think I would be well received. I'll be happy to come. Or not, even if I'm not well received, I'll be happy to come and cast the cat amongst the pigeons, as we say in English. That really, I'm a traditional Mysore teacher, but non-traditional at the same time. So anyway, I don't need to go further into my teaching. You can find that if you don't know already on the website or on the social media posts, whatever. Anyway, today we're going to talk about advice as a teacher, advice for a young teacher, but not necessarily young, as my wife pointed out, although she's not a teacher. We're not necessarily a young person, but a young teacher. Now, when I started teaching, I happened to be both a young person and a young teacher. So I was lucky in a way. What I didn't know. And so, you know, in many ways, I was kind of quite confident to start with because, you know, you're lucky if you don't know what you don't know. As I grew older in my teaching, slightly older in my years, because I started teaching probably when I was about 20, how old was I? 22 or 23, you know. And at that time, you know, really it was just like, and no one was teaching. No, and if you could find yoga, you were lucky. No one had done yoga in your classes. And so people would just say, oh, you know, you're doing yoga. And you'd say, yeah. And they didn't even think what type of yoga or anything, you know. It's like, they'd say, well, okay, would you teach me? And it just kind of rolled like that, really. So I did one podcast a few times ago on how I got into it, I think. And yeah, it was a serendipitous thing, which I didn't really plan to. If you didn't know already, I was a cook. I was a vegetarian cook. So I kind of boxed myself into a corner there, really, becoming a vegetarian and then becoming a chef. So my work portfolio was slightly limited. There was only certain London restaurants I could work in. And so it was lucky in a way. And now it's different, obviously. You've got higher end vegetarian restaurants. But at the time, there was definitely a limited career trajectory there. So let's say it was lucky I found yoga, but obviously, as I've talked to you before about as well, it was a lifesaver for me. Maybe not exaggerated. It really was something which turned my life around from going a bit downhill, let's say. Anyway, not talking about that today. Advice for a young teacher. So let's stay on point, Adam, and offer you a few ideas. Even if you're not a young teacher, these are things that have helped me. So stay tuned in and we'll see where it goes. Well, first of all, as a well-known yoga teacher said to me once, all behind all yoga teachers is someone with a bit of money or someone with a proper job, right? Which is certainly the case. And I have to mention my wife, Teresa, again today, that you know, she had a proper job for many years, a corporate job. She worked, I'm not going to say where, but she worked a proper job. And she allowed us, me, to be this yoga teacher who often wouldn't make much money at all. So it's really hard if you're just relying on yourself to make money. And I don't know whether I would have got to where I was today in terms of being able to have the time, luxury, and really being allowed to be myself, you know, when I would have had the pressure of making a living and other yoga studios, which I didn't really, you know, to be honest, I didn't really worry about them. I was really lucky because I did have Teresa. So, you know, I know it's not possible for a lot of you and you're relying on yoga for your income. And so therefore, you know, you're kind of between two worlds in a way, what you want to teach and the way that you want to say things and the way that you want to be and the way that you feel, at least you feel it's, even if it's correct or whether you're second guessing how the studio wants you to be and how the students want you to be, right? And we can fall between two stools here and not pleasing ourselves and, you know, not necessarily pleasing the studio either, you know, because, well, they're, you know, they can be hard to please, can't they? Let's be honest. I don't know. I mean, there's no easy fix to this. I probably, if I'd been on my own, let's say, I probably would have carried, which I did, in fact, before I was with Teresa, it did both. I did my my cooking and I did the teaching. And so therefore, I wouldn't have such a fear about trying to please the students. Of course, I think it's important that you do look to being effective and being pleasing for your students, because that's a litmus test about how you're translating your knowledge, you know, how you're translating a tradition of general principles into specifics, right? That's all we're trying to do is pass on very general principles, and they are very general if you look at them very carefully, i.e., you know, concentration, moving your body, with concentration, and maybe certain tricks in terms of moving your body with concentration to increase the effects. Like, it's like a magnifying glass to increase the effect of that concentration and the energy, kind of compressing the energy back into your body. Right? The whole yoga subject is kind of general, right? Like, you're trying to do something better for yourself. You're trying to develop your consciousness. You're trying to become more these are all very ambiguous and general terms, right? So, in which case, we're trying to apply them specifically to specific practical instances and specific individual people. Then that's where we come in, you know, and that's where you need your own flavor. You need to say it in your own way with your own voice. And, you know, it's hard. It's hard because it takes confidence, and sometimes that's underpinned by financial worries and necessities, right? If you're doing it, you know, as a profession, then, you know, there's bills to pay. I'm not going to say it's easy, but they're always, you know, there are always possibilities to try different things, let's say, even out of difficult circumstances. And I've been in a number over the years. I've kept on, you know, because I think it's easy to think, oh, well, this guy's here. He's got this podcast that's semi, you know, well-known, or, you know, whatever. You know, but, you know, he's doing great. You know, like, I bet he, you know, always was lucky with the yoga. You know, but I wasn't, you know, I haven't been. And I have had my downturns for sure, and my upturns. And but throughout it all, I think the thing that just kept me kind of going and somewhat able to turn things around, so open-minded and willingness to try different things and keep trying different things, right? And not be afraid to stick my neck out for trying to be honest, genuine, and turning up as a authentic person in front of another person. That's ultimately what we're trying to do. And I suppose I haven't exactly gone through these in sequential order, my notes, and I have got notes these days. We've got this software called Riverside. Thinking of a podcast, worth looking at Riverside. But anyway, it's now got this thing on the top, which has got like a script. I put my script and then I never use it. I just waffle on. Sorry. So I could have been more structured, but I'm saying a number of things that I hope do hit home, that, you know, ultimately, what really people want is you to turn up as you, as a real person, and not as someone, I know, we could name names, right? Certain yoga teachers, because you see that everyone could be derivative, right? And even the best teachers, I noticed I was listening to some teacher the other day and thinking, well, I can hear shades of Richard Freeman in that, or I can hear shades of, anyways, you know? So it's easy to kind of hide or take on other people's ideas and present, even styles of presentation. But ultimately, we just have to have the confidence to bear all. And that's scary, to just be in front of someone as yourself, because it's easy to hide behind a facade or a persona, right? But people want real people. That's all. I almost think it's, you know, in modern yoga, which is maybe a more practical, more practical landscape, let's say, than classical yoga, which is a little bit more esoteric. But in modern yoga, you know, we're really trying to, you know, we're doing it for the sake of this world and for the sake of integrating ourselves in this world and in our lives and our relationships, in, you know, in our material goings on. And, you know, and so, you know, according to that, we're looking equally to do the similar thing as teachers, be real people in front of real people, and not enlightened beings and not knowing everything, just, you know, genuine, honest, and somewhat caring, we hope, you know. And I think, although I'm not sure that we could ever fully put ourselves in, you know, to fully empathize with anyone, really, you know, if we've got the ego identity going on, which I don't think we should get rid of. I think we should still have our ego identity going on if we're living in this world. But I think we can't, you know, unless we lose that completely, we can't put ourselves in another person's position. It's always slightly hypothetical. But at least we can think about, you know, things like, what is this? How was I then? You know, I often think, given this instruction or giving this physical assist or, you know, working with this person and being like this, how would I have taken that? You know, how do I appear to this person? You know, and knowing that, you know, God knows what they're going through, and we're all going through stuff all the time. Maybe they're going through something specific, though, as you have probably turned up to yoga class in pieces, just hoping for a bit of peace of mind. And then, you know, you come across a teacher who, with a tough word, a sharp word, or, you know, is acting in a certain way that, you know, it's just important to never second guess the student and always try to best you can to put yourselves in their position and think, well, you know, how would that come across to them? Which is hard, because obviously you're conducting a class, even if you're not doing a lead class, you're in a Mysore class with a bunch of people. So that's difficult to put yourself in that position, but we have to keep trying. And that's really the thing that has kept me going, to be honest, as a teacher, because I can stand up in front of classes up to this day, you know, and I've done it for since 2001-ish, right? So, you know, a stupid amount of time now, you know. And you'd think, as I said, you know, in a way I was more confident at the start, you know, just being ignorance is bliss, as they say, not being understanding what I didn't know. So these days I stand up with a little bit more information, at least, and a little bit more experience, we hope. And I could be more nervous these days than I was at the start. So I don't think you'd ever necessarily stop having that nerves. And I don't think a little bit of nerves is a bad thing, because it puts you in the place of being alert, trying to make things fresh, trying to appeal directly, and motivates you somewhat, right? And it makes, you know, keeps things going, keeps things a little bit fresh, let's say. But, you know, on the other hand, I don't think I could stand up in front of people and do this without knowing that the reason I'm doing it is that it's just helped me so much. So even if I kind of feel like this idiot standing in front of you, i.e. me, you know, I still feel, look, it's not about me. It's about the teaching. And if I can convey the way that I understood it to someone else and they can get anywhere near a segue towards what I got out of it, then that's great. So, you see, you know, I think that's the old cliche, I suppose, of putting yourself aside, isn't it? But, you know, somewhat we can do that. Let's just say, well, it's not exactly about me, although you have to contradict myself here. Say, you also have to be able to do it in your own way. And when I first did a TT, I have to admit, and it was one of the first Ashtanga yoga teacher trainings that there was an offer, I think, probably the first one. There's a 3-year British World of Yoga training, and that was in London, right? No, it wasn't in London, but in England. So that seemed super long at that time. You know, 3 years, come on now. Anyway, John Scott in Cornwall was offering one that was, I don't know, it was maximum a year. You went back 4 or 5 times and stayed a week or two and did his training, right? So I was a cook. I went down to live in Cornwall and I took his training. And I have to say, after the second one, after the second of maybe 6, I quit. To put a long story short, I quit because I just felt like, you know, John is so charismatic, but I felt like I would become John. I'd become a mini version or a bad version of John had I stayed in that training. And I had to just become myself. You know, I had to find that. And it was a longer journey, I have to say. It was a much longer journey. And much of the things that he said that I didn't really or wasn't able to take on at the time have come back years later to my understanding in my own way, right? So I had to find the information myself. And, you know, some people, I maybe if you're a bit smarter, you can go on these TTs and keep yourself intact and take what you can out of them and leave the rest and become your own person. But for me, I felt like, you know, maybe as a young person, I was maybe 21, 22, I felt like I would lose myself and I needed to go on my own and find this information out on my own. So I did this long, sequentious journey to Purple Valley and to Crete and to Oxford. I went to Ian MacDonald in Oxford many times and studied with Jim Freeman there. So many teachers I went and tried to get something out of, I suppose, let's be honest. And in the end, I realized that, you know, I had to try and find it my own way. Not to say that they couldn't be good guides as well, okay? Moving on then, not knowing is actually your power. So I'll be a little bit sequential now. You can see I'm reading my script, not knowing being a power, because it gives you context. If you don't know what you don't know, then actually it's a certain kind of wisdom in that, right? And I've definitely used that to my advantage over the years, and especially obviously in things like adjustments, where I've never really wanted to push people because I thought at the time, and rightfully so now, I think, I don't know what pushing on a person's body is going to do. It might give them a little bit more stretch, but you know, everybody's bodies are connected in a different way, and you don't know what's going to happen. So I always felt I didn't know in about adjustments, and so I touched very lightly, and that's born out now in the fact that, you know, adjustments have, unfortunately, adjusting a body to a place where they can't go themselves. This is what I talk about, adjustment, not physical touch, is usually sooner or later injurious. I know it's not always a popular opinion. I know some people will disagree and say, well, I've had adjustments and they've been great. And it can feel good. I'm not denying that. It can feel super good. I've had adjustments as well. It can feel great. And, it can feel like open. You can feel freedom. It can feel exhilarating. But sooner or later, that usually doesn't end in a good place because the body hasn't got the framework to contain that next level of flexibility that we're moving into, right? So another thing, another aspect of the teaching is that you're always going to have people, as I mentioned now, that disagree with you. Say, well, you know, stick their hand up and say, no, I like, you know, when you're talking at the workshop or even a class, no, I don't agree with that way of doing that posture. No, I think the adjustments are good and I'd like you to adjust me in this posture and push me. Blah, 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 right? You know, you can't, obviously we can't please everyone. And those students will be pleased by another teacher who does those things, right? And let them do those things, right? I wouldn't advise it. So, you know, you talk to the people, teach the people, connect with the people who connect with you. Don't waste your time. Not to say these people are a waste of time, but don't waste your time connecting with the people that you aren't connecting with currently, trying to convince them that your way is the best way or the right way. Because of course it's not. In the first place, you offer suggestions, right? You never go head to head with someone. That's really not a good idea ever. I never go head to head. I always take it from the principle to use a common business phrase, the customer is always right. So I'd rather the person feels like honored and heard and respected in the class. And we can talk in the long term about my ideas about something once I've gained their trust. But why should we expect someone to gain our trust straight away? Anyway, coming back to the previous point, because I tend to do that as a kind of dovetail a number of different points into one or two sentences. Coming back to the last point, which I don't even remember what it is now. No, to connect with the people in front of you, because, you know, we don't change people usually by arguing the toss with them. In other words, trying to convince them rationally and practically about why your idea is better or right. There's no right way after all, you know. I mean, what are we trying to get after all? A greater degree of flexibility? Well, why even to that? A greater degree of safety? Yes, certainly. You know? But you could, you know, but some people, and I was one of them, you can't tell, you know. I couldn't tell me that I was injuring myself for many years. And luckily, I didn't do myself too much damage, to be honest. But, you know, I couldn't be told. And you know, because it's emotional. When you move your body, it's emotional. People are volatile. I was volatile. You know, it's stuff comes up because you're moving your body and you're not rational necessarily. At least in the yoga room, you're probably the least rational. And then the teacher's telling you this or that, you know, and it's not a rational conversation usually. And so as a teacher, you should probably know that and know that you don't change people's opinions by arguing rationally with them necessarily, usually. Yeah. I always do this. I find one thing that you can get the person that they want help with. Go to what they want. They want help with a certain posture. And it's usually one of the more, you know, let's say advanced ones or, you know, kind of exciting ones, right? Demonstrative ones, a pincher, a kapotasana, a leg behind head, a jump back, whatever, you know, it's fine. I, you know, again, like I don't belittle these things because I was exactly the same. And so you go and you try and help them with what they want. If you can do something sensible and good there, like and be, you know, successful with helping them a little bit towards what they want, then you're going to win their trust a bit, which is how human relationships work. Why should we expect it? I wouldn't want it any other way. I wouldn't want someone to come to my class and assume that, you know, I was the ultimate authority. They'd want, you know, and we should be, you know, because no teacher is, I have to say, even a good authoritative one can't know what your body's like really. So you have to be the one that is in control and the ultimate authority here, whilst being respectful and considering their ideas. Yeah. So one, I offer suggestions, don't offer conclusions ever. You know, it's always an explanation of the student, you know. But the other thing is that, yeah, to try to kind of convince them by finding something they want to work on and do it, and rather than saying, you know, because my teacher, Darby, I was going through much more than he would have thought was a clever idea, right? When I met him doing all advanced series or whatever, you know, he didn't stop me. He just worked on what I wanted to work on. And having success with what I wanted to work on, I started to listen to the things that were more, quote unquote, boring, like, you know, how to do a Surya Namaskar, how to do a forward fold, you know, all those things I thought I knew, you know. So you get the person rather than going head to head and say, no, you should come back and do only this much yoga and, you know, you're not there yet in your advanced series to do, you know, if it's, you know, listen, even if you might feel that they're doing themselves an injury, you know, it doesn't really help if someone says, look, you're doing yourself an injury. That's not going to help. That's just going to give fuel to the fire, is it? So you try tactfully to help them where you can, yeah, and give them as much string as they need, help them where they can, and gradually you might be able to gradually coax them into helping them with other things. And then in the end, and it's happened loads of times, listen, it's happened loads of times that in the end I've had a student and they're doing way too much, really. They haven't got the foundations yet to do that much. And I hadn't stopped them, haven't disencouraged them, haven't told them that they're being dangerous or injurious to themselves, because that's kind of annoying to say the least. All I've done is help them where they wanted help with and gradually gained their trust. And in doing so, then they've started to say, well, what should you think I should do? How much do you think? Because we know in the end, I knew I wasn't doing anything. That's why I came to Derby in the first place, because I knew that those advanced series felt wrong, felt like just shapes. And I was ready to hear it, but not ready at the same time. Yeah, you know, we're complicated beings, right? So, don't be dogmatic. There's another point I listed on my little script here. Well, that's obvious, right? Because you must know if you've taught for a while, even if you practice for a while, you have different opinions. They've changed, right? They do change. Like what I would have said 5 years ago, I mean, for one example that comes to mind directly is feet parallel and backbends. Someone asked me about this recently. And I think they told me that I said it before, I should always keep the feet parallel and backbends. Well, I've used that instruction. It's an advanced instruction. I've been given that instruction by my teacher, Darby, my Western teacher. Obviously, I've been to Mysore. Whatever. I've changed my mind about that. You know, for many people, I say turn the feet outwards because you've got tight hip flexors. It's very stressful on the hips to keep the feet parallel. It's much harder. Turning the feet out gives more space at the sacrum. You've got a natural rotation of the femur and the acetabulum. So you can use that. For many people, that works for a long time, much better than the feet parallel. So just a small example of something that I was very, very specific on, telling everyone to do that, you know. And the other thing is, you know, which is kind of does fit in here, is that you teach from where you're at. You teach from your own experience. You teach from what your own body conveys to you. And you're teaching from privilege, aren't you? You know, if you're a yoga teacher or anyway, adept at, you know, if you can do a primary series, let's say, you're the 0.1% of people with the most natural ability, flexibility, let's say, in your body. And you're teaching from a point of privilege. You don't understand, you know, we don't understand from that point of view how it feels usually without a lot of work or without an accident or difficulty in our lives to be in a place of less mobility, yeah, less openness, let's say. I don't like using that word really, but, you know, so. Yeah, it's hard, but keep trying to open your mind, look at people, and just look at the thing is to try and look at someone directly without the filter of they should do. Just trying to take that out of the equation first of all, your normal instructions, and then just look at actually how their body's moving. And sometimes you can come, you know, if you wipe the slate clean and you're really with them without all the backlog of all your information, all the things you've been taught, all the things that work for you, you could actually look and you could say some funny things that might surprise you. Honestly, I'd say some funny things like, actually, why don't you just turn your hands in now? Or, you know, things that I would think, that's not right. You know, like if I'd heard that, I think, you know, but for certain people, you know, you know, it works. You know, I've said some weird things before. Like I would never usually say, on a pragmatic level, if you know, if I saw that on a kind of explainer on YouTube, I'd think, oh, that's weird, you know. But you know, we're all so different anatomically and at different stages, different instructions might be relevant, right? So for one person at a certain time, right, that are they starting off, certainly the hips should be turned out, rotated externally slightly, the feet turned out slightly, might give more space, but gradually then maybe they turn the feet in over time. So, or for Baddha Konasana, I always say this for Baddha Konasana, first of all, as you're coming into Baddha, as a younger student, you would externally rotate the thighs, so they're rolling backwards, yeah? And then once you're in the posture, certainly as a more adept student, you're actually rolling those thighs forward as you pull back with the body. So it kind of reverses, in a way, from and depending on what level you are with the practice, with your body. So, yeah, main takeaway point there, probably, you know, trying to clarify what I'm saying, is that, you know, be aware that you're teaching from a place of supreme privilege, most probably, that you are, even if you're not flexible within the Ashtanga community, because that's the 0.00001% of people, right? You've got a skewed sense of perspective there already. You're certainly flexible considering your friends and your relatives, right? You know, and your cousins or whatever, you know, in terms of your body. So, yeah, it's not easy because you've got blinkers on, most probably, right? Next in the script, just don't forget that the yoga tradition is new. I know. It is a new thing, though, you know, doesn't mean yoga's new. It means that the way that we're currently doing it, modern yoga, what people will talk now, and not everyone likes this term, modern postural yoga. This is a new thing. The way that we're approaching yoga now is from Krishnamacharya, or the Krishnamacharya, Sri Yogendra, and a couple of other teachers, Aurobindo would be one of them. Kavalyananda would be another one. And they were innovating around the same time, around the start of the 20th century, using yoga asana in a much more dynamic way, in a much more concentrated way than ever was used before, and for yoga therapy in a much more pragmatic way for the sense of therapy, not for the sake of waking kundalini or attaining samadhi. Yeah, which are the two other older iterations, right? Tantric yoga in the 18th century to the from the probably the rather 12th century to the 18th, you get tantric yoga, and that's for the sake of awakening the kundalini or getting rid of the kundalini, in fact, if you're Krishnamacharya. Before that, classical yoga, which was really for the sake of concentrating the mind to essentially exit the body, really, to attain samadhi and not get reborn in the world of suffering again. So we can see different usages. And in the 20th century, we come up with a different innovative usage. And it's, yeah, people like Krishnamacharya. Let's stick with Krishnamacharya because he's the kind of the granddaddy of our tradition, let's say. And he synthesizes, let's say, he puts together parts of classical yoga, parts of Hatha yoga, the tantric model, and new ideas. You know, he brings a lot of postures into the fray, into the modern yoga canon that were never there before, right? Before that, there's kind of, 84 postures, I think, is the Hatha Pradipika includes 84 postures, Sri Tatmanidhi, Yoga Amaralga, maybe. There's a few texts that have a number of yoga asanas, but nowhere near what Krishnamacharya is teaching or what we're doing now. So, and then nowhere near usually as well. Let's say they are dynamic. I'm not going to say they're not dynamic, actually, but more dynamic. So, we are doing a new thing, and it doesn't mean it's not real. Doesn't mean it doesn't work. Doesn't mean that it's not powerful, really powerful, and even more than materially, or even more, even it can lead to even a further experience other than, it's helping me in my life and, with my relationships and with my aching hip or back or whatever. It still could be more than that. It could be a pathway to more than that, I think. But we have to find new ways to come into that, new ways to describe it for ourselves, new ways to understand. If tradition, and yoga, they're always context sensitive. So to make anything out of tradition that's effective and relevant in the present, you have to make it relevant to the present without slipping into repeating myself or tautology. You have to adapt tradition, not religion. But, in a certain way, tradition is using repetition, right? Now we're using repetition and religion is based on the same thing of using repetition. So it's just finding, and that's basically practice, right? Repetition is practice. So finding ways to suit that practice to the people in front of you in a way that's accessible, relevant, understandable, and doesn't involve a leap of faith that they have to believe for X, Y, Z amount of time or forever. They can finally understand the benefits right now and test it out themselves, right, in a short amount of time. So don't worry if you feel that you have to modify the traditional Ashtanga sequence or whatever your tradition of yoga is, because I like to think I'm speaking to people that are not just doing Ashtanga. If you have to add things in that you feel are yours, even to make it appropriate to the person in front of you, that they come back and they're interested and it works for them and it's safe for them, that it's comfortable for their bodies, that they enjoy it, do so, right? What's the point in being super traditional, right? Going everything exactly by the book and the person just leaves. And you say, that person wasn't suited to the tradition, right? Maybe they would be 10 years later down the road to when they can read the small print. They're interested in it now. But, when you get a new car, you don't study the manual first of all. Do you get in the thing, you have a little drive around, you enjoy it. The same thing with the yoga. Worry about the manual later. Don't worry about the small print later. Get the person into it in any which ways you can. First of all, they have to enjoy it. Has to feel relevant, accessible, and good for their bodies. Yeah. Do what you can. You're not being inauthentic. You're not being untraditional. If you need then to modify things and make them appropriate. I know I always say this so much. It's boring, isn't it? Anyways, so that means kindness as well. That just means looking at a person, connecting with the person in front of you, and that's kindness, right? It doesn't mean mollycoddling them, as we say in English, like you're, there kind of thing, wrapping them up in a blanket. It just means being with the person, caring about an actual individual in front of you, right? Realizing that there is an actual individual in front of you is care. Yeah, that comes care and interest comes with realizing that there's a real person in front of you. And that comes from realizing also that you're a real person in front of them, which is getting a bit deep. And maybe we can't go along those lines in terms of how to do that in this podcast. But, being authentic to yourself Try to be confident, have the courage of your convictions, and have a support behind you. You know, have a support network so you feel that you can be yourself, even if that means taking a part-time job so you don't feel you have to rely on the yoga so much, or finding a mentor. Like I mentioned in a post recently, find a mentor that doesn't have to even be a yoga teacher, but someone you can go to and speak to regularly. I used a therapist for years, talking therapy, or acupuncturist as well, you know. Someone you can be with that you can feel like cares for you, or allows you to be for a while, right? Even though I wouldn't say, you know, a spouse, a partner, a friend, it's a bit difficult because it's not impartial then. So I choose someone, even if they weren't a yoga teacher, that could be impartial. Yeah. So being kind is much more important than being right, having all the information. Getting your message across in exactly the right way, conveying the Ashtanga tradition in exactly the right way, being kind. That's the most important thing we can do. And that doesn't mean being all lovey. It might be, but more than anything, it means turning up authentically in front of a person to recognize that they're also a real person in front of you. If you can do that, oh my God, that is so powerful. Two people in front of each other as themselves. I don't want to over-exaggerate or risk going to hyperbole, but that is a powerful thing, isn't it? That's where transformation happens. And yeah, we're still trying to do that in yoga. Don't get me wrong. We, you know, although we're not maybe raising Kundalini up through the spine, we are still, you know, yoga. One definition of yoga could be, you know, we could say yoga is concentration, but, you know, I'd say yoga really is attempt at transformation, a really radical change, you know, in a being, a radical shift of perspective. Yeah, a shift of energy in the body is a shift of perspective, you know? So, yeah, I mean, it has high aims. I always say yoga, it's a low entry. Like anyone can do it, you know? There's no, these days, you don't have to stand in the sun for days holding one hand up. But high entry, low entry bar, high qualification bar. Right, so the qualification is direct experience. Yoga will settle. Yoga is practice, so it means it will settle for nothing other than direct experience. Whereas, you know, Samkhya, for example, the sister of yoga, is knowledge, is knowing stuff. It doesn't necessarily, well, generally, you know, it doesn't know so much rest on the direct experience of practice so much as understanding, you know, that in the end you have to understand the knowledge in Samkhya as well. So it is direct experience, but maybe it's a rubbish metaphor. But I think maybe you get where I'm going with that. So when you change, you know, when you turn up in front of someone as a person, you're not trying to change their body. You know, the transformation happens to themselves, and it's a long process. And that tension, that holding patterns in their body, they're deep. They may be generational. They may, at least they're, you know, they've been there for a long time, and you can't break, you know, with the best will in the world, you can't break people out of those patterns. They have to unlock those patterns from the inside out because they're emotional. They're psychosomatic in the proper use of the word, i.e. not hypochondriac, but, you know, literally related to emotions, related to psyche, and expressed in the body. So they, you know, they go, so the roots of these tension holding patterns are so deep, and they change through the whole of one's perspective and life changing, not just through an adjustment or through a clever cue or through making that person come every day to practice, you know. Silly ideas, right? These things are a long-term process so what if we have holding patterns as well? You know, I mean, who cares? You know, we want to be more comfortable in our bodies, but we don't have to do Kapotasana to do that. And we don't have to do Kapotasana to be a more evolved or happier human being either. So, yeah, it's not our job to change people. It's just our job to hold that space, you know, which is hard at times because it seems like not enough to just hold a space open, you know, for people to have their journey, to experience it. That doesn't seem like, oh, you know, it feels like, oh, I've got no value anymore as a teacher if I'm not really teaching the information or giving adjustments. This holding the space, it doesn't really mean, you know, I won't be taken seriously. But you know, people want nothing more really than a space to be themselves, a space to experience themselves. And like, you know, it's like having a ball of string in your hands. And if you just gently toss it and let it be, you know, gradually you can tease the thing apart, yeah? But if you try and yank at it, like a teacher kind of pulling at your body and pushing, the whole knot becomes bigger and the two people become knotted together in a fight. So it takes a lot of confidence just to allow the space. And you can give some little pointers here and there and some suggestions, but allowing space and not trying to change someone or break them out of a pattern of tension because, well, you know, the patterns of tension are there for a reason, right? And they go deep. Right? I mean, You don't want to change them necessarily. And also you need, I mean, and don't forget you need tension patterns as well. Otherwise you'd be a bag of bones on the floor. You need a kind of right tension in the body. It's just that certain tension patterns are partly right and partly maybe not necessary anymore. And so they need to be amended to develop and to, you know, in where you're at now. You know, maybe there were holding patterns that were necessary at the time that were created due to emotional conflicts at the time, stored in the body, but they're not necessary now. And they're still being carried around and they're outdated. Yeah? They're the past impact on the present, and you want to live presently in a more connected way. And this outdated tension pattern is getting in the way of that. So, you know, because, you know, what I want to say here, which I can think you can see underlying this, is that, you know, there's nothing wrong with tension in the body after all, you know, and there's nothing great with being able to achieve any of these postures, really, if you think about it. And obviously, if you're a younger student, that doesn't make so much sense because, you know, as I did, you think, well, what are you talking about? I'd love to be able to do that. But, you know, after a time, you kind of think, yeah, you know, why am I doing that? And that's a valid question. Why am I trying so hard to do that? It doesn't mean you don't try so hard anymore. It just means there's a looseness around that trying. Yeah, and things aren't just one way or another way. Yeah? They don't just have to be like, either you try now or you don't care anymore, you know, or you push or you just let go. Yeah, it's not that, it's not as simple. You know? It's like you still try hard, but you just don't try it with a sense of strain or fear or judgment or need, so much need anymore. It's getting a bit more lighthearted, I suppose. Anyway, there is a way. There is a way. Anything else I can say? Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, don't go head to head with people. It never works. You never want to call rank, you know, like, I'm the teacher after all, listen to me, you know. Like, convince people from the outside in, give them time, let them come to you, see if you can get them where they want to go first of all, and then you can give them a little bit of what you'd like to see in their practice, yeah? But you're also offering suggestions. If you can't tolerate the people not doing what you say, then maybe that's a bit of a problem, you know. People, no one's going to do exactly what you say all the time, right? And people, you know, I feel the space should be more generous and open than that, because you don't just need a whole army of people practicing exactly how you want them to do. You know, you want people enjoying that space that you've offered to them. And that's the, I think that's still the biggest gift we can give people, a space, a non-judgmental space to be as they are, you know, because also they might be doing something different and you think, well, I don't like that, I don't, you know. And then it's like, you know, you realize that your perspective is one moment in time, and a number of years later you might come back and think, actually, you know, that's not so bad the way they were doing that. So you never really know, you know. So I always think, stay humble, because it's easy to trust your current perspective too much, right? This is the way. And I've had so many different changes of mind over the years that I kind of felt, hold my opinions a little bit looser now. Yeah. Yeah. And to end up, I think I've said in the script, find a mentor. I do emphasize that. You need someone to support you in this journey as a teacher, even as a practitioner. I don't think yoga is a one-stop shop. I've always used, as I said, talking therapists or acupuncturists or homeopathy, I like. Just massages. Just go to a masseur once a week who you like, who's a nice person, and you can feel like a good connection. You know, some space for yourself, some space for you to unwind and let go. Yeah, because you're carrying a lot. You know, people are unwinding a lot of tension, a lot of drama in your classes. You're probably going to pick up on that somewhere in your body. If not, it's a stressful profession anyway, to degrees, and you need someone there to support you and give you a different perspective. You know, because things will come up, and it's the only profession that really, you know, it's like every other profession, from mechanics to hairdressers to, you know, counselors, to architects, they all have mentorship programs, you know, frameworks, right? Professional coaching, we don't have that. So I think that's really missing from the yoga scene. And as a young teacher these days, you don't grow up as you would have done when I started, where you really learnt from being with a teacher for a period of time, and then they said, oh, you know, you ever got a teacher, you know, like, well, you know, these days you just come out of a TT and then you're there on your own generally, you know. The person on the TT usually isn't still there for you, and that's a shame. I think they should be. I think if I ever do any training, I always try and emphasize, look, I'm always around if you'll be interested in, if you're interested in keeping this relationship up after this is finished. Anyway, listen, I've got on long enough. There's a few ideas, and I think I've covered a number of ideas. Yeah, let me know your thoughts. As always, I haven't presented everything, I'm sure. I know I haven't presented everything. To which end I would say, know your blind spots, or know that you have them, right? And keep humble, and keep caring, and keep inspired. If it doesn't inspire you, if you can't make it fresh, if it's not interesting to you anymore, something's gone wrong and you need to look again at your practice or your teaching or go to some classes or read some stuff just to reinvigorate yourself. Because it's not, if you're just turning over the same old information, and you're not excited by it, how can you expect someone else to be interested and motivated by what you're teaching, right? So this will be the end of the podcast today. And next week, you'll have a proper show with a proper guest, I hope. I know, because I recorded them. And with the podcast, let me know if you feel like there's any guests I haven't asked yet. I've probably asked them already and they've said no. But message me and let me know. And I hope to see you. I hope to see you somewhere this year. I'm coming to many places. So if I'm not coming to your place, also drop me a line and I will come next year, right? If it's not too rainy and cold. Or I come in the summer season. Okay, so that's me for now, and I'll see you again next week.